The court, Carolyn Sacco for Emery Barron, the appellant. We are asking the court to reverse the district court's grant of summary judgment to the defendants, and I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Granted.
For 6 years, Emery Barron woke up alone in a small cell where he spent at least 23 hours a day surrounded by nothing more than constant blaring music and the yells of other inmates in adjoining cells. On the rare occasions he was permitted to leave, he was subject to regular strip searches. And appellees kept him in these conditions for years, even as his mental and physical health deteriorated. These conditions give rise to two claims that should have gone to the jury. An Eighth Amendment claim grounded in appellees' deliberate indifference to the harms Mr. Barron suffered while in prolonged solitary confinement without legitimate penological purpose, and a 14th Amendment claim arising from appellees' failure to comply with due process by providing Mr. Barron with only a sham review that did not meet the minimum requirements set out by this court. And finally, there is an unrelated Eighth Amendment claim arising out of appellee's indifference to Mr. Barron's serious medical condition of sarcoidosis, which resulted in his legal blindness while incarcerated. I'd like to start with the procedural deficiencies inherent in the review process Mr. Barron was provided.
Just going back to the beginning, you don't dispute that prison officials were justified in placing Mr. Barron in solitary confinement in 2015. Based on his actual assaults on correctional officers, do you?
No, Your Honor. The dispute arises from his prolonged solitary confinement for years after this initial solitary confinement, at which they used nothing more than the original initial misconduct to continue to justify that confinement over time, making it nothing more than what this court in Sowerbier calls a rote repetition of misconducts and behavior.
So when did the step-down program process begin? 2017?
Yes, Your Honor. He was placed in a step-down program originally in 2017 and was there for a year and 5 months. But while in the step-down program, he remained in the same restrictive housing unit as he was supposed to progress through the step-down program, during which he was also provided very limited guidance about how to move through the step-down program, how that would actually earn him out a place into general population out of solitary confinement. So those step-down program reviews also did not meet the minimum requirements set out by this court, and Mr. Wetzel remained the final decision maker over his case.
So after step two, he threatened to kill a corrections officer, is that correct? 2019.
Yes, Judge. There was a misconduct in 2019 where he was alleged to have threatened an officer who he had made multiple complaints about, Mr. Barron, for harassing him during strip searches, Officer Dare, on multiple occasions. It's not necessarily the court or the Department of Corrections did not necessarily offer that misconduct as the reason that he remained in solitary confinement. I believe there's a review from 2019 or a vote sheet that the program review committee offers to Mr. Wetzel, which they argue that his bad attitude and negative perceptions were impacting him in solitary confinement at that point, which is again very similar to what this court found deficient in Sowerbier, which was like a standoffish attitude that's not enough reasoning at the point of these reviews. But again, the primary violation here was that Mr. Barron was provided no opportunity to even informally make his case to Mr. Wetzel, who was the Department of Corrections designated as the final decision maker over his placement. And this court has very clearly laid that out as a requirement in Schoetz by incorporating the requirements from Hewitt v. Helms into regular reviews. And that was later made crystal clear in Williams in 2017 when this court found that there must be regular, meaningful reviews with a meaningful statement of reasons for continued placement. At no point was that made clear by the program review committee. You can see in the record at multiple points, they simply state that he would remain in solitary confinement because of his restricted release list status and continue to talk to him over and over again. At one point, a corrections counselor even tells him to smile more. He's just really not given any specific guidance about how he can earn his way into general population.
He did. With regard to the step-down program that he was involved with in 21 through 23. So I guess the theme of today is when do you cross the line? In this case, when do you cross the line from where there's an Eighth Amendment violation? I guess you start off by saying it's duration of confinement.
Yes, Your Honor.
But there's not a... there's a balancing act here, and you can't have somebody in the general population, if he's acting out and threatening corrections officers, it just doesn't work. When do you cross the line?
Yes, Your Honor. Here, there had to be cut at the point at which the duration matters, the point at which his solitary confinement became prolonged, which this court has found to be as little as 7 months, Clark, and as little as month stints over a period of years in Palakovic. What's important here is that even if this court can rely on informal evaluations and predictions by corrections officers and staff, like it shows, that's not happening here. This, the corrections officers, the program review committee, and Wetzel, by signing off on it, was relying on nothing more than largely his initial misconducts and vague hand-waving at his behavior while in solitary confinement that would not make up the substance of an original decision to keep him in solitary confinement or to place him originally. They're continuing to rely on his charges and his initial misconduct, even as far as 6 years into his solitary confinement. And to your point about the step-down program in 2021, he's placed in the intensive management unit, not necessarily labeled as a step-down program, I believe in June of 2021, by a facility-wide memo sent out by John Wetzel to all inmates in his facility at that point, that after the, 6 months after this, the litigation in this instance had already been filed. I think that timing is particularly important here. But at that point, he had again already been in solitary confinement for almost 6 years before filing this litigation, far longer than this court has found to be prolonged in both Palakovic and Clark. So that time period is particularly important here. But if this court, I can also move on to the Eighth Amendment claim and the end appellee's deliberate indifference here. There were multiple instances where appellees specifically became aware that Mr. Barron was suffering from a serious mental health condition beginning in 2016 at Joint Appendix 273. Mr. Barron was placed in a suicide smock on at least one documented occasion. Appellees had full access to this record. There was also a hunger strike that Mr. Barron started because he was paranoid about something being placed in his food. And despite there not being a formal diagnosis, as there was in Palakovic and Clark, appellees cannot simply hand wave away this concrete evidence that Mr. Barron's mental health suffered through the constant isolation of solitary. And that became clear again as he continued to request full psychological evaluations, as were done in Schoetz, to determine that plaintiff's continued risk that would require him to remain in solitary confinement. So this is, again, at minimum, a factual dispute which should have been resolved in Mr. Barron's
favor. Was Mr. Barron's eye condition caused by the solitary confinement, or it arose before or in conjunction? Is there a causation issue?
No, Your Honor. Also, the Eighth Amendment medical indifference claim, which we were arguing that his eye condition worsened, is separate from the conditions of solitary confinement.
Right.
He had this pre-existing condition of sarcoidosis that worsened because of the delay in his medical appointments and the surgery that I believe he was supposed to receive. That defendant Cronauer here acknowledged that he had the appointments for and noted he would look into them, and they were delayed for such a long period that resulted in him going legally blind as the result of that condition. So it's separate even from the conditions separately in solitary confinement that were resulting in his the harm to his physical mental health separately over time.
You also allege the confinement conditions were lacking heating, ventilation, air conditioning, it would be ventilation, part of ventilation, and was rodent infested. They're obviously quite concerning, but why wasn't there any, what record evidence is there that creates a genuine dispute of fact?
Yes, Your Honor. Here, the court, the district court largely relied on the duration of the solitary confinement and the supposed access to certain privileges that Mr. Barron had to determine that he was not in prolonged solitary confinement at that point, or that the conditions were not negative. What we would argue is that at the point at which the solitary confinement became prolonged, regardless of these other conditions like the music, the rodents, that underscore the isolation and physical impact of solitary. Simply being in prolonged solitary with a serious mental health condition for over the minimum period of time that this court has established, that is what allows the Eighth Amendment claim to continue here, and the district court wrongly resolved that in favor of the appellees at
Is that a per se standard you're asking for then? I'm sorry, follow.
Not in terms of, we're not asking the court to find that solitary confinement is per se unconstitutional, but prolonged solitary confinement, again, at the length of time that occurred here with the defendant, with the plaintiff here, Mr. Barron's serious mental health condition. That's what this court has made clear in Porter, as well as previous cases, or as well as subsequent cases, Palakovic and Clark, as well as in Williams in 2017, which was a 14th Amendment case, but incorporated much of the same reasoning. The recognition of the harms that isolation specifically, that being in this small cell over years-long period of time has.
These are all contextual, circumstantial elements, and we've never held, I'm sorry, anyone has ever held that solitary confinement, segregation in detention of any sort is a per se violation of the Eighth Amendment, right?
Again, Your Honor, it's as a result of the deliberate indifference to the serious mental health condition that Mr. Barron suffered while in solitary confinement, and the unique harms of prolonged solitary confinement here. So,
even not really an Eighth Amendment claim, then. I mean, it starts to almost sound substantive to me that you're almost sort of blending the Eighth Amendment claim with the due process claim to kind of create a new right that, if these facts exist, then you have a liberty interest, if you will, to be free from them.
No, Your Honor. Porter, again, a similar Eighth Amendment violation was found in that case based, again, on similar conditions that plaintiff was in, yes, for a longer period of time.
Oh, yeah,
but also
there was a much longer period of time. Yeah, and it sort of suggested that that was a possible cause of action. I don't think it actually held that those things were. I just sort of tried to ground, is your argument really fact-based? And if so, what do we do with the evidentiary problems that, you know, that Judge Ambrose is pointing out? And if it's not, is it a legal standard, then where's the legal standard coming from?
Yes, Your Honor. Yeah. We argue that the reasoning from Williams was imported into Eighth Amendment jurisprudence in Porter and in Palakovic and Clark, points at which this court has found a prolonged solitary confinement at a much shorter duration than it found prolonged solitary confinement in Porter, and which Mr. Barron's period of solitary confinement clearly meets here. So while, yes, there are these, again, factual disputes about whether or not these allegations Mr. Barron is making in his complaint, the point is that he suffered, this court has recognized the very unique harms that plaintiffs with mental health conditions suffer while in prolonged solitary confinement for a year's long time. And that's specific in Porter. This court has mentioned the updated research and a large acceptance of the unique harms of solitary confinement, specifically on mental health.
Is there a difference between an inmate who spend 6 years in solitary confinement, period, versus one who spends 6 years in solitary confinement because during that period he's had multiple disciplinary incidents that prevent him from coming out or put him back in?
Again, Your Honor, we'd argue that here there's a dispute of fact about why, again, Mr. Barron is remaining in solitary confinement for 6 years. They're relying largely on his initial misconduct.
Misconduct. I understand the facts are contested, but just from an Eighth Amendment perspective, is there a difference between 6 years period versus 6 years with, you know, with arguable facts thrown in?
Your Honor, at that point, there can be an argument about legitimate penological purpose,
of
course, that can be made. However, here, yes, that the right here at issue is qualified by whether or not appellees could find a legitimate penological purpose.
Right. That's what I'm getting at. Yeah.
However, here we'd argue again, there's a dispute of fact about whether or not there was a legitimate penological purpose for keeping Mr. Barron in solitary confinement for 6 years, and that appellees themselves don't particularly seem to articulate one until the response brief, in case they're the Department of Corrections, again, is continuing to rely on his initial misconduct.
Okay.
I believe
there's pending charges as well from participation in the prison riot. Is that correct?
I'm not sure exactly what you're referring to, Your Honor, for Mr. Barron here. I believe he's pending charges right now. He's
Not pending charges, right?
I'm not sure, you know, he's out on, he's recently released, so.
I'll ask your colleague on the other side.
Yes, Your Honor, I can get that information.
Okay, thank you. I'm not sure. Has she lost it?
Yes. Or a reason, maybe a reason.
Yeah.
Okay. Hey, please, the court. I'm Jeff Palladino. I represent former Secretary John Wetzel and three employees at SCI Dallas, late former Superintendent Kevin Ransom and Deputy Superintendents Cronauer and Miller. In this case, Mr. Barron sued. I'm eager to talk to you about this case, Your Honors, because it demonstrates the tightrope prison officials have to walk. On one side of the tightrope, you have an inmate, Mr. Barron, who's twice assaulted officers, sucker punched, attacked unsuspecting officers at two different institutions. And they don't want to give him a third chance to do that because the consequences could be dire. On the other hand, we can't be indifferent to his mental health treatment, and we weren't. So we're balancing his individual rights against prison security and making difficult judgment calls about when it is safe to release him in a general population. I want to talk first about what is in the record and isn't in the record about psychological decompensation for Mr. Barron, because I believe that this is a key point that distinguishes this case from some of the other cases that we have regarding solitary confinement. We put in his inmate cumulative adjustment record, in a summary judgment record, and it shows weekly, monthly, over and over again, a member of the psychology team would check in on Mr. Barron, and it was, you know, the same type of entries. I spoke with Mr. Barron, asked him if he was having any problems psychologically. He denied. He denied self-harm, denied injury, denied mental illness. And I told him that how to access psychology if he needs to, and there were no contraindications to keeping him in the RHU.
One obvious distinction between this case and Palkovich and Clark is in those cases there were diagnosed psychological problems. Your friend says, all right, there was no diagnosis, but like he was in a suicide, he was on a suicide watch. You know, there were signs that should have put people on notice that he had psychological problems.
Sure, and let me talk about that. There's no, even in his unverified complaint or in his briefing, where Mr. Barron has ever alleged that he was suicidal or expressed suicidal ideation. My friends on the other side are great lawyers, superstar future lawyers, and they scored the record for some evidence of him being a suicide spock. And what we have, what we have is a period of about a week where a psychological service associate, this is a JA-273, went up to Mr. Barron, tried to talk to him about an incident or an investigation, noted that he was in a suicide smock and he was on movement restriction and wasn't able to talk to them. And when they eventually were able to see him, he denied any mental health concerns. So what they're asking you to do is speculate, and speculation is not enough to overcome summary judgment. The same thing about the hunger strikes. It's not clearly established that the hunger strike itself is a mental decompensation. You know, sometimes it's behavioral, sometimes it's manipulative. And really, we're looking not at whether or not these mental health evaluations were adequate, but we're looking from the perspective of John Wetzel and the employees at SCI Dallas who were reviewing the same records that you're reviewing the summary judgment. And they're saying Barron denies any mental health issues. If you look at the restricted release reviews that were conducted by Central Office, every one of them has a stability code written on them.
How does administrative custody interact with restricted release?
Okay, so going to the due process issue, basically, an inmate who's on administrative custody has...
I mean, I'm talking factually. How do they interact?
So an inmate who's on administrative custody gets reviewed every 90 days by the program review committee, and they at any point can recommend that that inmate be released to general population or recommend, like we did in this case, that he go to a step-down program. And the only difference between a regular administrative custody person and someone who has a restricted release designation is the secretary or someone from the executive office, the policy's changed over the years, but at that time it said secretary or designee, has to give the final sign off. So that it's a that is one check. That check is designed to make sure that someone's not released too early into general population from central office, but they also had, former Secretary Wessel also instituted another check for the reverse reason, that he does his own annual reviews. The central office has their own annual reviews of these inmates to make sure that they're not kept in solitary confinement too long. So there's really two processes that are in place that work together. One, the 90-day review by the Program Review Committee. The second is the annual review by central office. And you know, my friends on the other side pointed out that I acknowledge that in 2020, in the middle of COVID, some of those annual central restricted release reviews were delayed. So Barron didn't get one in 2020, but the Program Review Committee reviews continued. And district courts have noted that, and they've noted the reason was COVID. And really, COVID is a backdrop of this whole case. The time he was at Dallas, where he sued most of the people, he was only there, by the way, for about 7 or 8 months before he filed suit. The timeline on that is that he went to Dallas in November 1st, 2019. And then in March 30th, 2020, he was transferred. Inmate cumulative adjustment records reflect that he was transferred to SCI Chester for an eye appointment, and then he got stuck there during COVID because the transfers weren't coming. And then he eventually makes his way back to SCI Dallas. I believe it was November 2019.
But he was still
and then,
either...
And then he filed suit two months later.
He was still in solitary confinement or in... some type of step-down program from 21 to 23, right?
Correct. So after, sure, he was in a step-down program two times.
What information did Mr. Barron receive to let him know what he had to do to progress through the step-down program?
So I put in the record the memo that described the step-down program, but really the most important thing to look at is the step-down reviews that are in the record. So... he received weekly reviews that he went over with him, and these involve his individual recovery program, which is designed with in coordination with his psychological team. So some of these reviews even mention that there were some personality testing done to help design this individual recovery plan. And the identified goals for Mr. Barron, and this is JA372, but there are numerous of these RRL step-down program reviews. Maintain misconduct-free behavior by working on in-cell treatment work, it says initiated. Avoid acting on angry emotions by developing an understanding of empathy, initiated. Learn and practice skills to be in a more pro-social position, initiated. Work through traumatic experiences by working on in-cell treatment materials and journaling, initiated. Now, they're calling this a sham, but the business of rehabilitating human beings so they don't turn from someone who randomly attacks corrections officers into someone who's released into the general population safely where they could walk around and have an officer with their backs turned to them isn't an exact science. And they're doing the best they can to come up with a plan to rehabilitate Mr. Barron. And, you know, really all he had to do was stay free from misconducts, which he did not do. And they gave him several... chances. You know,
what about the conditions of the cell? Lacking heat, ventilation, air conditioning, rodent infested.
So he's alleged that in his unverified complaint, but he never. There's no evidence in the record that Wessel was knew about those conditions. He was deliberately indifferent to them, or that any of the named defendants knew that there was a rodent problem that went unaddressed. And, you know, what's missing most of this record, going back to the psychological issue, is any grievance by Mr. Barron that say, I'm decompensating. I mean, he filed all these request slips, letters to Wetzel, as part of a summary judgment exhibits. If you go through all of them, you do an independent review of the record, there is nothing in there where Embry Barron says, I'm not being treated properly, I'm decompensating, I'm feeling suspicious. There's nothing that's obvious to these decision makers who he sued that the psychological reviews were insufficient, that the ones that say that he's a stability A inmate, doesn't have any mental health issues. So it all goes back down to deliberate indifference, whether it's the mental health or whether it's the prison conditions.
So Williams, Porter, Palkovic, Clark, they don't say, but they, you know, sort of gesture that the individual, that solitary confinement may become an Eighth Amendment problem. How do we prevent, how do we prevent Barron from becoming the next one of those? Or why shouldn't Barron become the next one in that line of cases?
There's no bright line, Your Honor, and they're difficult judgments, and that's why qualified immunity in these cases is important. I would say that in this particular case, Barron's entirely distinguishable from Clark, from Plakovic, because of the prison officials expressly noted their mental health, serious mental health issues, schizophrenia.
Yeah.
What other options are there besides solitary confinement for keeping someone out of the general prison population?
Every time Mr. Barron's freedom is increased.
No, what other, forget for the moment the individual, what other options are there besides 23-hour a day solitary confinement are there for keeping someone out of the general prison population because of the threats that person is perceived to give to the population or to corrections officers?
I can tell you what the Pennsylvania Department of Corrections has done. We've reformed restricted housing. Inmates now who are in extended solitary confinement for a prolonged time get 3 hours out of cell a day, two for exercise, one for where they sit at a restrained table, like a Texas table, where they can interact with other mates. And Mr. Barron had, some of these step-down reviews talk about, if I look at, for instance, when he was in the step-down program, at SEI Cole. I believe this is JA-256. And again, they're saying that the step-down program wasn't materially different from his conditions. That's not accurate at all. On August 28, 2018, the entry says, inmate Barron was offered and accepted 1 hour of activities education. Today's lesson plan was on physical fitness and conditioning, which was very well received by the group. Inmate Barron participated and even had a friendly contest with inmate Lights, who was seated next to him. The class then watched and discussed a video of the essentials of dumbbell training by Juan Santana, health and fitness areas, important areas of interest to this inmate, no further actions. So those are the types of things.
You mentioned other options possibly. Was Mr. Barron allowed to avail himself of some of those other options, starting with, let's say, 3 hours out, some interaction with other inmates? Was he given those opportunities?
During the step-down program, he progressed from phase 5 to 4 to 3, and he was given greater freedom, and this was part of the step-down program. So there was additional out-of-cell time. And then his behavior deteriorated with that increased freedom when he started to get the misconducts.
He was put in solitary in 2015, and the first step down program was in 2017. What was done during those 2 years that caused the prison officials to say he continues in the solitary confinement?
Sure. So the first year, he got about 5 misconducts. Covering the camera in a cell in May 2015, refusing an order to be fingerprinted by the Pennsylvania State Police, in July of 2015, removing a vent cover from a cell in March of 2016, a contraband misconduct in May of 2016, and refusing to obey an order again in May of 2016. So he's accumulating DC time during that first year, and he's not sued the, you know, he's not alleging the there was a due process violation with his hearing examiners or his hearing. He hasn't made a separate claim about his disciplinary hearings. So part of that was DC time. And then after that, the following year before the step-down program, they were giving him privileges at the reviews. And that's a behavior modification tool. You know, you start off with a few privileges, you behave, and then you get a tablet, or you could email people, you get increased phone calls. That's to drive his behavior. And after a year, when his behavior improved, that's when they felt comfortable to use their judgment that it was time to give him a chance at the step-down program. So that's what happened in the first 2 years.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor. Yes.
Your Honors, I'll just start with my friend on the other side started with this point about his psychological decompensation and serious mental illness. The appellees in their response brief provide this kind of laundry list of record citations with these five-minute checks where either corrections counselors or people from the psychological services department, who I'd like to emphasize are not psychiatrists or psychologists providing full evaluations to him, but instead are eliciting check-ins from him in front of his cell door, in front of other guards, other incarcerated individuals, with this very short period where they are simply just checking in with him and listening to what he says, and it's not designed to actually elicit information on his mental health. There's at least, at minimum, again, a factual dispute here, looking cumulatively at the evidence that appellees actually had of Mr. Barron's psychological decline, the suicide smock, his multiple requests for psychological treatment and evaluation. That's also evident in his deposition here. He says he hasn't spoken to a psychologist, so he can't say whether or not he has a diagnosed mental health condition or not, because he has not actually been able to speak to anyone despite multiple requests. It's also not a requirement, despite Palakovic and Clark underscoring the pre-existing condition in that case, that an Eighth Amendment claim may stand. In Porter, there was no pre-existing mental health condition. All that was required in that case for it to survive summary judgment was a corrections officer having direct knowledge of mental health decline. What's relevant here is appellee's knowledge of Mr. Barron's mental health decline and what they thought, not necessarily a explicit mental health diagnosis. And again, the cumulative facts here demonstrate that he was decompensating. Also point to, again, the step down program here. The distinctions here only point to between administrative custody and RRL. They frame them as an additional check, but here there was, again, 2.5 years in between when, in 2019, appellees supposedly review Mr. Barron's claim on a yearly basis, and then when they pass it on to Wetzel again in 2021. There's no COVID defense here. There's no legitimate penological purpose defense to 14th Amendment violations here. Mr. Barron did not have a chance to speak to Mr. Wetzel in the entirety of the time that he was on in solitary confinement, even on an informal written basis to make his case. And that's clearly required from Schoetz. I see that's time. And this is for the questions.
Okay, thank you. Thanks to the Boston University Appellate Clinic for taking this case pro bono. And Ms. Sacco, excellent job, really. Are you still in school? Or?
I just graduated 2 weeks.
Congratulations. Really well done.
You're screwing up, you're studying for the bar?
Yeah. We'll catch up.
Thank you, both sides, for your excellent advocacy, and we'll take the case under advisement.